The cigar smoke hangs heavy in the Havana air. It is January, 1959. A man in olive drab stands on a tank. He is 32 years old. The crowds are screaming his name. They see a savior. They see the end of a playground for the American mob, and the beginning of a Cuba for Cubans. But history is rarely that clean. Behind the cheers, the firing squads are already forming at La Cabana. The promise of bread and literacy is tethered to the reality of the prison cell and the single party line. Fidel Castro did not just lead a revolution. He became the state. For some of our people, he is the giant who stood up to empire. For others, he is the reason their families are scattered across the Florida Straits. We are looking at a life defined by the tension between defiance and control. We are looking at the man who turned an island into a fortress.
Chapter 1. The Sierra Maestra. The water was gray, and the boat was sinking. It was December 2, 1956. 82 men were crammed onto a yacht designed for 12. The vessel was named Grama. It was an old wooden boat, bought in Mexico, with sweat and secret donations.
These men were not soldiers yet. They were lawyers. They were doctors. They were rebels. They hit the coast of Oriente Province and stepped into a swamp. The mangrove roots tangled their legs. The mud pulled at their boots. Batista's planes were already circling overhead. Within days, most of those men were dead or captured. Only a dozen or so made it into the deep green cover of the Sierra Maestra Mountains. Fidel Castro was one of them. He told the survivors they had already won. Most people would have called that madness. Life in the mountains was a lesson in survival. Our history shows that the peasant farmers, the campesinos, were the first to see the change. They lived under the thumb of rural guards and wealthy landowners. Then came these bearded men. They shared their food. They taught the illiterate to read by the light of campfires. They promised land reform, but there was a hard edge to this kindness. Castro enforced a strict code. Informants were executed. Desertion was not an option.
The revolution was a machine, and it required absolute loyalty to the man at the top.
This was not a democracy in the making. It was a guerrilla war. The mountains provided the cover, but the radio provided the reach. Radio Rebel Day began broadcasting from the peaks.
The voice of the revolution cut through the static of the cities.
It told the people that the dictatorship was rotting. It told them that the wealth of the island belonged to them. While the United States continued to back Fulgencio Batista, the rebels were building a shadow government in the woods.
They established hospitals and schools in territory they controlled.
They were proving they could govern. The contrast was sharp. Batista's police were torturing students in Havana. The streets were stained with the blood of the young.
The middle class, once wary of the bearded rebels, began to turn.
They wanted the violence to end. They wanted the corruption gone. They did not realize they were trading one strongman for another. By late 1958, the momentum had shifted. Che Guevara led a column toward Santa Clara.
The government's armored train was derailed with a bulldozer and homemade grenades.
The soldiers of the regular army had no heart left for the fight. They were fighting for a paycheck. The rebels were fighting for a vision.
On New Year's Eve, Batista packed his bags and fled to the Dominican Republic.
He took the gold and left the ruins. On January 1, 1959, the gates were open. Castro did not rush to the capital. He took his time. He processed across the island in a victory lap that lasted days.
Every stop was a speech. Every speech was a promise.
When he reached Havana, the city exploded. People climbed on top of cars. They waved the red and black flags of the July 26 movement. They thought the struggle was over. But the transition from rebel to ruler is a bloody business.
The trials began almost immediately.
In the stone courtyards of the old Spanish fortresses, the firing squads went to work.
The old regime was being purged.
There were no long appeals. There were no nuanced defenses. The revolution was settling its debts.
Castro stood before the microphones and told the world that revolutionary justice was different from the law of the bourgeoisie. He was signaling that the old rules no longer applied.
The initial months were a whirlwind of activity. The elite social clubs were open to the public.
The beaches were no longer private property.
The rent was slashed by half. For the poor, it felt like the world had been turned upright for the first time. But for the bankers and the landowners, the floor was falling out.
The American companies that owned the sugar mills and the phone lines were told their time was up.
The tension with the North began to vibrate. Washington looked at the executions and the nationalizations and saw a threat. Castro looked at Washington and saw the enemy he needed to define himself.
The honeymoon was short.
The island was being remade in the image of its leader. The question was no longer if the revolution would succeed, but who would be allowed to live within it. As the first year closed, the shadow of the Cold War lengthened over the Caribbean.
The charismatic lawyer from the mountains was now the undisputed commander. He had traded his suit for permanent fatigues. He was no longer just a man. He was the maximum leader. The schools were being built. The clinics were opening. But the newspapers were being silenced.
The prisons were filling with former allies who asked too many questions about elections. The grit of the mountain was now the grit of the state. The lines were being drawn in the sand, and the stakes were nothing less than the survival of the island. But as the first Soviet tankers began to dock in Havana Harbor, a new pressure was mounting. The neighbors to the north were not going to watch in silence. The stage was set for a confrontation that would bring the world to the brink of fire. The revolution had survived the mountains, but could it survive the siege? Chapter 2. The Siege Mentality. The Bay of Pigs was a disaster that became a myth. In April 1961, a force of CIA-trained exiles landed at Playa Girón. They expected an uprising. They expected the Cuban people to join them. Instead, they found the nation mobilized. Castro did not direct the defense from a bunker. He was in the mud. He was on the front lines. The invaders were crushed in less than 3 days. For the United States, it was a humiliation. For Castro, it was a gift. It allowed him to declare that the revolution was officially socialist. He told the people that they were now the front line against global imperialism. The threat from the outside was the perfect tool to consolidate power on the inside. Internal dissent was now framed as treason. If you were against the government, you were an agent of the Yankees. This was the era of the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution. It was a system of neighborhood watch groups. They kept track of who went to church. They noted who complained about the food lines. They watched who received letters from Miami. Our history shows a society turning inward. Privacy was a luxury the state could no longer afford. While the surveillance grew, so did the social mission.
The 1961 literacy campaign sent thousands of young people into the mountains to teach the poor. In a single year, the illiteracy rate plummeted. Healthcare became a right, not a purchase. These were the twin pillars of Castro's legitimacy. He was giving the people the tools to live, while taking away their right to speak.
The tension reached a breaking point in October 1962. Soviet nuclear missiles were being installed in the Cuban countryside. The world held its breath for 13 days. The island was a pawn in a game between giants. Castro was furious when the Soviets agreed to remove the missiles without consulting him. He felt betrayed by his allies and hunted by his enemies. This birthed a permanent siege mentality. Cuba became a garrison state. Every citizen was a soldier.
Every workplace was a cell.
The economy was being strangled by the American embargo, which the government called the blockade. Scarcity became a way of life. You learned to fix a car with wire and hope. You learned to stretch a ration book. But there was a darker side to the socialist utopia.
The government had no patience for those who did not fit the revolutionary mold.
In the mid-60s, the UMOP camps were established. They were military units to aid production. In reality, they were forced labor camps. They were used to correct those the state deemed social deviants. This included religious leaders, intellectuals, and gay men. They were sent to cut cane under the hot sun to purge them of their counter-revolutionary traits. It was a brutal attempt at social engineering. It showed that the revolution's definition of equality had very strict boundaries.
You were equal only if you were exactly what the state wanted you to be.
The 1970s brought a false sense of stability. The Soviet Union was pumping billions of dollars into the island. In exchange, Cuba exported its revolution. Cuban doctors went to the slums of the world.
Cuban soldiers went to the jungles of Angola and Ethiopia.
Castro was no longer just a Caribbean leader. He was a global player. He was the voice of the non-aligned movement. He was challenging the status quo from a small island. At home, the standard of living was rising.
The shops had Soviet goods.
The electricity was more reliable. But the cost was a total dependence on a superpower, thousands of miles away. The island had traded American influence for Soviet subsidies. By the 1980s, the cracks were showing again.
The pressure of the system was pushing people to the edge.
In 1980, thousands of Cubans flooded the Peruvian embassy in Havana seeking asylum. Castro responded with a characteristic move. He opened the port of Mariel. He told anyone who wanted to leave to go.
But he also emptied the prisons and the mental hospitals, forcing those individuals onto the boats heading for Florida.
Over 120,000 people left in a few months. It was a massive bloodletting of the population. It was a way to vent the pressure, but it also tore families apart.
Mothers stayed while sons sailed away.
The trauma of the sea became a permanent part of our cultural memory. The decade ended with a shock to the system. The trial and execution of General Arnaldo Ochoa in 1989 sent a shiver through the military.
Ochoa was a hero of the African wars, but he was accused of drug trafficking and treason.
Many saw it as a purge of a potential rival,
It was a reminder that no one was safe, not even the heroes, not even the men who had bled for the cause. The revolution was getting older. The hair on the maximum leader's chin was turning gray. And across the ocean, the Soviet Union was beginning to crumble. The wall in Berlin was coming down. The subsidies were about to stop. The siege was about to become a famine. The island was alone in a sea of capitalism.
The people had been told for decades that socialism was the future. Now the future was disappearing. The lights were about to go out across Havana. The true test of the system was not how it handled the victory, but how it would handle the hunger.
Chapter 3. The Special Period.
The collapse was total. When the Soviet Union vanished in 1991, Cuba lost 80% of its trade. The ships stopped coming. The oil stopped flowing. This was the beginning of the special period in peacetime. It was a polite name for a desperate struggle. The weight of the average Cuban dropped by several pounds. People ate grapefruit peels fried to look like meat. Bicycles replaced cars. The cities went dark for 16 hours a day to save power. Castro stood on television and told the people that the revolution would not surrender. He called for dignity in the face of ruin. But dignity does not fill a stomach. The state was forced to change. To survive, Castro had to invite back the very thing he had expelled, the dollar.
Tourism became the new lifeline. Foreign companies were allowed to build luxury hotels on the same beaches that had been nationalized decades before. A two-tiered society emerged. Those with access to foreign currency could eat. Those who relied on the state peso suffered. The doctors and teachers who had been the pride of the system were now making less than the waiters in the tourist zones. It was a bitter reversal of the revolutionary promise. The equality of the 60s had become the shared poverty of the 90s.
In 1994, the pressure boiled over. For the first time since 1959, there were riots in the streets of Havana. The Malecón, the famous sea wall, was filled with people screaming for change. Castro did not hide. He drove directly into the heart of the crowd. He stood among the angry people and stared them down. He used his presence as a weapon. Then he used his old tactic. He opened the borders. He told the Coast Guard to stop intercepting the rafts. Thousands of people took to the water on inner tubes and wooden planks. They were the balseros.
They risked sharks and storms to reach a shore that would have them.
It was another exodus. Another generation lost to the Florida Straits. The late 90s saw a slight easing of the pain. The arrival of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela provided a new benefactor.
Oil began to flow again, in exchange for Cuban doctors.
The island found a second wind. But the aging leader was slowing down. The long speeches were becoming more rambling. The world was changing, and the digital age was knocking at the door.
The internet was a new frontier that the state viewed with suspicion. It was a tool for connection, but also a tool for subversion. The control of information, which had been so absolute in the age of radio and print, was slipping. In 2006, the inevitable happened. Internal bleeding forced Fidel Castro to hand over power to his brother Raúl. It was meant to be temporary. But it became permanent. The man who had dominated every aspect of Cuban life for nearly 50 years vanished from public view. He became a ghost in a tracksuit, writing long columns for the state newspaper. The transition was quiet. There was no explosion, no civil war. The system he built was strong enough to outlast his physical strength. But it was a system frozen in time.
The world moved on, while Cuba remained a museum of the mid-20th century. Fidel Castro died on November 25, 2016. The government declared 9 days of mourning. His ashes were carried across the island in reverse of the victory lap he took in 1959.
The crowds lined the roads. Some wept with genuine grief. They remembered the literacy, the pride, and the defiance. Others watched in silence, waiting for the era to finally end so they could begin to breathe. He was buried in a simple stone monument in Santiago, near the heroes of the War for Independence. He wanted to be seen as part of a long chain of resistance. He wanted his legacy to be the survival of the Cuban soul. The cost of that survival is written on every peeling wall in Havana.
It is seen in the families who have not seen each other in 30 years. It is found in the brilliance of the doctors and the silence of the poets. Fidel Castro was a man who loved his country so much, he refused to let go of its throat. He gave the people a sense of history, but he took away their sense of the future. He stood up to the most powerful empire in the world and won. But his people lost the right to choose their own path. Our history is not a fairy tale of a hero or a simple horror story of a villain.
It is the story of a man who believed that the end justified the means. He left behind a nation that is educated, healthy, and trapped. As the sun sets over the Malecón, the young people sit on the seawall and look north. They are proud of who they are, but they are hungry for what they might become. The revolutionary is gone. The strongman is dead. But the island remains, still waiting to see if it can finally be both free and whole.